You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt. Or it's not even the morning. It's the afternoon, actually.
Oh, yeah. Who knows? I think we're both a little sleep-deprived. Yeah. But
good, that is the truth.
Good to talk with you, as always.
In historic day... I'm actually a little surprised that the media coverage was so gushing about the historic nature of it. It's been so protracted. I wouldn't have assumed it should get that much attention put on that aspect of it. But the fact that the early numbers for her were very strong, and then confirmed by the California vote. You know, she dodged that bullet of having the whole race end on a sour note, and so she could, you know, bask in the moment for once in her life.
Well, she's doing something right, my son. I've not given them a lot of prodding. I just sort of. You know, see what they come up with. My 5-year-old is supporting Hillary for some reason. I'm not sure why. If the historic thing, or if it's some sort of indoctrination at his preschool, or
so,
what?
So nothing happened inside your household to have that he just came to you one day and blurted that out.
No, I try not to be judged. Like, I try not to push him one way or the other, because frankly, you know, it's there are no good options in this race. So I've not tried to bias them.
But have you had a conversation that, you know, you're generally a Republican and you're a conservative? I mean, have you gone down this path at all with them?
No, I haven't gotten into that. I mean, we talk a lot about they love George Washington. They love the Hamilton soundtrack, the parts that I allow them to listen to. They're not too edgy. And I tell them about, like, who's running for office, and now they know it's between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And I did tell today about that she would be the first woman president. Mm-hmm. But he's been pretty consistently on the Hillary and the Hillary camp for the last month or so, for some reason.
Interesting.
Yeah, I try not to bias it. I'm curious what is up. Maybe Donald Trump is just so repellent that even a child picks up on it.
I went into parenting telling myself I'm not gonna show my hand. I'm not going to try to force them to share my political views, because that's a recipe for backlash.
Yeah, you got to be
careful.
It's
going to go the other way.
You
so
gotta
I don't
careful.
I don't want to tip my hand. But, you know, a year ago, I have a couple of books called Presidential Pets. There are a few different presidential pet books out there. And you go through it. You know, I have two daughters. You go through it. You know, they start to recognize that there are no women presidents in this book, and they bring it up to you. It's actually quite an annoying conversation to have with a 5-year-old or 6-year-old. When Hillary announced, you know, it was an opportunity to say, hey, look, there is a woman running. Here it is. This is what it looks like. And so as soon as I did that, they immediately said, we're for Hillary. And I wasn't even trying to, and they put it to me, well, who are you going to vote for? And I was like, well, I don't know. I need to see what the candidates say. and then I got pressured, you know?
Yeah.
So
make no mistake. I mean, I don't want to come across sounding like an angel here. I mean, if Marco Rubio were the nominee, I would already have my kids out going door to door. So, but as it is, I decided to sort of not bias them. And so here we are.
But yeah, I was at my elementary school's talent show a couple weeks ago, and there was a group of fifth graders that did a play that was mocking Donald Trump. And I saw another part of Massachusetts. There was a there was an incident where a different talent show, three boys did a silly dance number wearing oversized Donald Trump masks. There wasn't even any words in the thing. They're just doing a dance wearing Donald Trump masks. That was the entire thing. And then some parent gave the school an angry phone call. How dare they mock Donald Trump? And then they told the kids they couldn't do a repeat performance for another installment of the talent show. But it all just makes me think to what extent Trump is kind of a punchline with kids, because he's such a buffoonish character.
Yeah.
I just have to wonder. I mean, obviously, I'm in a Democratic part of the country. Maybe it's not true across the board, but it wouldn't surprise me if it just sort of he's a standard joke to kids.
That would be very interesting. I mean, people usually children reflect the attitudes of their parents. And in fact, I don't know if you remember this, Bill, but in 1984 there was this newspaper called the Weekly Reader that little kids in schools would get. And they did a poll.
Right. They do surveys, right?
I think we've talked about it here before. Yeah. And Reagan won in a landslide, the Weekly Reader poll, and that was sort of a harbinger of things to come. But I wonder if it would be fascinating to know, or if there is some sort of a dichotomy of children. You know, it's sort of like the way that this will sound horrible, but the way that, like, my pug could sniff out good people from bad people, you know, like better than I could, you know, they have this sense about them. And maybe children are able to sort of sniff out Donald Trump demagogues better than some adults. I don't know. Curious to find out the answer to that one.
Well, to circle back to last night, I mused on Twitter whether it would have been better for Bernie to have conceded before California, knowing what we know now.
Mm-hmm.
He already has, he before California, he had 46% of the pledged delegates. It would be less once you factor in the supers, but it'll be well over the 25% a runner-up needs to force floor fights over the platform and the rules. You need 25% to create a minority report, and you bring a minority report plank to the floor for the whole convention to vote on. He already had that. He won 20 states. He already had the argument that he did vastly better than anyone would have expected, that he had the votes of young voters, so he can make I'm a candidate of the future argument. So he had all that going for him. But by putting so much emphasis on California, which he was always behind, I mean, and granted, the polls got closer than people were expecting, and you could understand why he thought it was a chance to win. But it was always a risk, and it now exposes the ceiling that he's always had. I mean, it's a higher ceiling than you might have thought, back in January, but it's a ceiling that nevertheless, he gave it the full effort, crisscrossed the state for days and days and days, and still lost by what it's apparently double digits, although I think it's unclear how much vote is still left to count from the mail ballots. I don't think it means he goes to the convention empty-handed. He still has his delegates. He still has an argument that, hey, if you don't come my way on certain things, some of my people are going to walk in November. You don't want that. But I would think his ability to be absolutist in his demands and really dig in his heels is diminished coming off of a big loss in the last day.
Yeah, getting no one to get off stage, right? I mean, that's the, Jerry Seinfeld sort of thing. You know, he ended that show. Well, the last episode sucks, but basically he ended on top. And, I used to play in bands many, many years ago. I always think people remember the first couple songs and the last couple songs you perform. Those should be your best, And in the middle, it could get messy. And I think if Bernie dropped out a week ago, it might have been, in hindsight, it might have been a better idea. So
Yeah, I think he's always had a problem with expectation setting, which I think is understandable. You're coming in as the insurgent. You need to get people to believe you have a shot. If everyone thinks you're a protest vote, you're not going to get nearly as many people to show up. So you have to give a sense that, you know, we could win this thing. There's a reason for you to go out and vote. We might actually win. And you know, whereas if you're the front runner, you could be a bit more coy and you know weather a loss here and there and still persevere. But Bernie, in a couple of key moments, I think, put a lot of emphasis on states where he did not have a good chance. I mean, it didn't make a lot of sense to me to go all in New York, her home state, and a close primary, and a state with an ample African-American vote. You know, why would you make that a litmus test of how well the revolution is going? That didn't strike me as a good strategy.
Let me ask you this, Bill. Do you have a sense that this was, you know, sort of a message, or is this just the product of a Clinton ground game? I mean, is it possible that polling showed this race a lot closer than it was because the tightening is a result of her having a really good operation on the ground?
Well, we know that she put a lot of emphasis in that mail-in vote aspect, which is very large in California, and the votes that we've seen are more, I believe, the mail-in vote than the day of vote. But you haven't had much of a sense on either side that ground game has made an enormous difference. Usually, ground game is a couple points one way or the other.
Yeah.
And a lot of states have been, you know, double-digit margin. So, you know, Iowa, I think Iowa ground game really mattered a whole lot to Hillary, because if she lost that, it would have been a whole different situation. And Nevada caucuses, you know, there too. I mean, again, if Bernie could have strung two in a row
I'm thinking of this.
That could have made a very big difference.
I'm thinking of this in terms of like what should Republicans take from this, and what should Republicans be afraid of? And I mean, either way, I think that Republicans, you know, have a tough task ahead of them beating Hillary. But is it a matter of her sort of being, you know, technologically advanced in terms of what she's doing on the ground? Or is this sort of like a mess, sort of a wholesale thing that she's
I mean, Hillary is running a very textbook campaign. A modern era textbook campaign. By you, she does what campaigns should do. She does not lollygag really any aspect.
They lollygag the ball to first base. I just watched Bull Durham the other day. You're the only person other than that movie that uses the term lollygag. You know what you are? A bunch of lollygaggers. Great movie. I think it's underrated. Well, maybe I think it's just. It's mostly for a forgotten movie, I think, sadly. It's a great movie.
Oh, who could forget Bull Durham? That's an absolute classic.
But do the youngsters of today, I mean, do the
well, maybe because no one plays baseball anymore, no one bothered to watch.
The minds full of mush in our newsroom. I mean, do they, these kids, the interns, I mean, do they know, I mean, I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. I believe there ought to be a constitutional amendment banning the designated hitter. I mean, these are amazing. This is good stuff. You know, I don't have to tell you that.
No argument for me.
Yes.
So I think the fact that she did those things, you know, saved her from real calamity early on. But by and large, this was a demographic divide, and it played out, I think, irrespective of the ground game in most states. And on the Republican side, you know, Trump was just a big personality, got a lot of media attention, you know, not a lot of close races. He probably lost Iowa to Cruz because he lacked a ground game, and other caucus states. You know, ground game certainly like matters for those. But when you have a big state, and as we learned, I think you get a lot of media attention and people are galvanized by the personality. They'll just show up without you putting a whole lot of nuts and bolts effort into it. But now you're going into a general election with a much wider pool of voters that you have to deal with. if Trump was to actually win, I mean, there's no argument that Trump beats Hillary in a landslide. That there's, Reagan Mondale 84, Reagan didn't need a ground game to beat Mondale 84. You know, that was just the country was in a zone and he was going to win, and that's that. Trump is not in a similar place right now. If he was going to beat Hillary, it would be gutting it out vote by vote. So to go into a situation where he's already behind, maybe you say Trump's doing better than expected at this stage of the game. Hillary's way down by losing some of her left flank from Bernie, but even still, she's ahead in most polls.
No, I mean, look, I don't want to derail us, but I was much more. Now, look, I need to separate. First, it's important that we separate how I feel about Trump versus my political analysis of Trump. But speaking strictly about political analysis, I think a week ago I was much more bullish on his chances than I am today. I mean, it's just been a brutal week for Trump. Mm-hmm.
Let's get to that in just a second. Yeah. But just to finish up what I'm saying here, here's a guy who has no fundraising apparatus, just barely putting one together, has a staff that is, I think, about a tenth of the size of Hillary's. He's bragging that he's lean and mean, but this is just, you're trying to win the votes of 60 million, 65 million people. You don't do that on a shoestring operation. There's a lot of human power needed to go door to door to drag people by their collar, get them to show up. And he has a fundamental disbelief that this is a necessary aspect of winning elections. Partly because he's been taught a bad lesson by how he won the Republican primary with a plurality vote, I might add.
You know what it is, Bill? A player never messes with a streak. A player never messes with a winning streak. And that's what he's got here.
Except there's only one game left to play. Streaks do end.
All right, this is my lame Bull Durham reference. But the larger point is, I think you're right. I mean, he thinks that what he's it's one of the worst things that happen is when people prosper by doing the wrong things, it reinforces the wrong things, and sometimes that is, I don't want to use the glass ceiling line, but people do hit a ceiling in their careers because the things that get you elected or help you, like, say, win at one level, you can't do again to get to the next level.
So to take up what you were saying before, this was a very weird week for Trump. You know, I mean, go back. I think it was a week ago where the State Department Inspector General released its report about Hillary's emails, which was not flattering for Hillary. And he almost immediately, in response to that, started talking about the Trump University judge. Any kind of, a moderately intelligent candidate or campaign consultant would say, well, you got a gold mine here with the State Department IG report. You got to drill this thing for days and days and days. He went off on a speech in San Diego and volunteered a 12-minute tirade on the judge in the case. For no reason, and has gone on a bender on that ever since. So now in attacking the judge for his background, he's now forced every elected Republican who has said they're going to vote for Trump to have to answer for everything Trump says. And I get that these Republicans don't want to outright abandon Trump by and large. They don't want to be accused of sabotaging him and dividing the party. They probably think he's going to lose, but they'd rather the blame fall on his shoulders and not their shoulders. But now they're in this position where every time Trump says something awful, you could ask the question, do you agree? And they clearly don't want to go on record backing racist statements that are going to hang over their heads for the rest of their political careers and their lives. So it just seems to be an untenable position that they're in.
Yeah, it's a disaster, and that's my roll call column this week, Bill. I'm not the only person writing this, writing about this very difficult position they're in, but that's what my roll call column is going to be. It should drop today.
So if you were sitting in a room with Paul Ryan and you just weren't in a room with Mitch McConnell, so I do want to talk to you about that. Would you say to them, look, it's cut the cord. This won't get better. So
I would. You I need would. To no, save I appreciate yourself. The I appreciate the difficult position that Ryan is in, because he's really trying to serve two masters. I mean, on one hand, he's trying to be the loyal partisan Republican who wants unity, who says, look, the voters have spoken. The primary voters, this is the guy they went with. We want to, you know, we need to have, you know, we don't want to give Trump someone to blame if he does lose. We certainly don't want Hillary Clinton to get to name, you know, three or four lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court. You know, the voters have spoken, the bastards. This is our duty as partisan Republicans. That's one sort of role that I think he's facing. And then there's the other role, which is being the conscience of conservatism, being the guy who, you know, let's say Donald Trump loses in 5 months, you know, the work of conservatism goes on, and we're going to need leaders who have not had their, you know, their legacies and their reputations tarnished by Trump to emerge and for sort of this thing to go in exile and then to be a government, sort of a conservatism in waiting. And I think both are, you know, both are important. I would prioritize, if it were me, I would prioritize his role, Paul Ryan's potential role, and I think he's abdicated this role. But I would have prioritized his role as a leader of conservatism that must be guarded and protected and cannot be, you know, besmirched or tarnished by, you know, racism, misogyny, all the things that Trump represents. So, but I think he's made that choice. I don't think you can have it both ways. I think that when you try to have it both ways, that in itself is a choice. And so I think that, look, there's that old Tanya Tucker song, it's a little too late to do the right thing now. I mean, even if Paul Ryan ends up abandoning Trump, I still think this will haunt him. I mean, 15 years from now, Paul Ryan's gonna be somewhere talking about how conservatism is the best philosophy to bring the most joy to the most people, about human flourishing, and someone's going to bring up, yeah, but you supported Donald Trump, who said this and said that and said this and said that, and it's kind of game over when he does that, when they do that.
Now, Steve Lonigan, who worked for Cruz in New Jersey, was on CNN. And he said, our delegates have an obligation to come July to do what's right for the Republican Party and not just anoint Donald Trump.
Hugh Hewitt has apparently said something similar. He is pushing now for some sort of a plan for Republicans to abandon Trump and to nominate someone else, too.
Now there's this one guy, you know, Politico did a story about him a couple months ago, who has argued that under the current rules, all delegates are unbound. There are no bound delegates. That's all a myth. Read the rules closely, and you'll see that they're
Curly,
all bound.
Curly from North Dakota. Is
that that's right. That's okay. Right. And now whether you believe his interpretation of the rules or not, at minimum, you could go into the convention and offer a new rule that says we, as the 2016 Republican Convention, decree that all delegates are unbound and it's an open convention. This is what Ted Kennedy tried to do in 1980 when he was short on delegates versus Jimmy Carter, and it wasn't really close, but he was arguing that he was a better general election candidate, and John Anderson, the independent candidate, said if the Democrats gave it to Carter, he would drop out. Kennedy tried to make his case, the delegates didn't go along, but in theory, you could do it. Now, you know, we went, you know, 20 rounds about this during the primary, where I was, you know, proven wrong that the Republican establishment would fight Trump to the bitter end. They did the exact opposite. So it's hard to see why they would suddenly have the nerve to take that kind of dramatic step.
All we have
which
seen
would
is cowardice, capitulation, and incompetence.
Right.
It's like so the new Romanism, and you know, I don't know. Yeah.
But you're closer to the Washington Republican establishment than I. Is there a change? Does overt indisputable racism?
I mean, I think
change the calculation.
But see, here's the thing: like this whole thing with this judge is no worse than. It's kind of like when all of a sudden we decided Don Imus was a, you know, whatever, a racist, a misogynist. Like, he had really nothing that he hadn't been saying for 15 or 20 years. And the same thing with Donald Trump. Like this is not really that much different than a lot of other stuff that Donald Trump has said the last year. I think the change is the media. Now, some people argue that this is because the media, or some people in the media, wanted to build up Donald Trump, help him win the nomination, and then predictably turn on him, which would imply that it's some sort of a conspiracy or a liberal bias. Others might argue that this is just an inherent sort of thing that the media does organically. That now that he is one step away from the presidency, that the scrutiny should naturally ratchet up, and that the coverage of him should naturally become a little more aggressive. But whatever the case may be, Bill, and this is like the whole pornography, you know it when you see it. I mean, it's hard to, it would be hard for me to document this, because the media, the media there've always been people who have been critical of Trump, but I just see like a sort of a quantitative and qualitative difference. I just sort of sense that in the past week, this is different, that the media is suddenly treating Trump much more seriously. And I think that's really the biggest thing that's changed, and that's forcing Republicans, whether it's Mark Kirk or whoever, Senator, who's the Arizona senator? I'm sleep deprived today.
Jeff Flake.
Whatever. Whoever it is, I think it's the difference of media coverage. It's not that Trump has changed. I think the coverage has changed.
Well, I might agree with that. 25%. I mean, I think the media covered every offensive thing that he has said the whole time. It wasn't like the media in 2015 was like, oh, that Donald Trump, what a card. He's such a character. Let's have more of this guy around. The John McCain stuff got plenty of negative coverage at the time. I think the two things that are different is, number one, you have far less candidates on the field right now. Everything gets amplified coverage because it's almost the only game in town. The Republican reaction is what's different. The Republican reaction to Trump in 2015, early 2016, was kid gloves. They were worried about alienating his supporters. The other candidates wanted to win his supporters over and didn't want to hit Trump that hard. The coverage is driven in the past few days by what Paul Ryan has said about Donald Trump and what Mitch McConnell has said about Donald Trump. They weren't doing that 6 months ago. That's what's different.
Well, this may be a Rorschach test type thing, or it might be like a chicken or an egg type thing. But regardless, I think we can agree that it seems like in the past week that the tables have turned, and that it's a different race. Donald Trump had, I mean, I remember sitting on the set in CNN a few weeks ago, and Hillary Clinton was getting beat by Bernie Sanders, and it was ugly and it was messy. And simultaneously, Donald Trump was like, had already basically become the presumptive nominee, and was coordinating with the RNC, setting up joint fundraising plan. I mean, Trump had this head start on her, and did not capitalize on it. It seems he squandered it. And it feels like the race, you know, I remember I was saying before that it's sort of math versus magic. I was saying before, for a long time, I felt like if you look at it in terms of demographics and the electoral college, you bet on Hillary. But if you look at it in terms of just the magic, like, you know, who's the change agent versus who's the status quo? Who's the disruptor in a time when most Americans are unhappy? It felt like the zeitgeist, to use a word that's very annoying, favored Trump, and it doesn't feel like that today. Now, you know, it's all, you know, it's June, and we've got a long way to go, but, you know, it seems like, I mean, if this is as good as, you know, it's possible that this is, it's possible that 2 weeks from now, Trump's got his mojo back. But this may just be where the race goes for the. I mean, there could be months and months of this. So,
well, I mean, if it's months and months, and the polls are stagnant, and assuming some of the Bernie voters get back into the Hillary fold, the lead is clear. I think it becomes kind of boring. You know, it just becomes an obvious end to. A strange year,
and maybe the media won't let that happen. Maybe we have to keep him in the game. I mean, again, this is, I'm not saying that there's a conspiracy. I'm just saying, like, it's in everyone's best interest that things go.
Well, you saw us with the California polls say there are polls that showed Hillary having a double digit lead, and polls that showed it being a 2-point lead. And so the media focused on the 2-point polls. It didn't focus on the double digit polls because you want there to be the chance of drama.
Yeah, and again, it's not like there's a big meeting where we all get together and say, "Hey guys, we got to get some clicks for the website." So, but you know, I think it's just a natural thing to do. It's an organic sort of understandable type of bot. I don't even know what you would call it. What kind of bot is it? Like, confrontation bias or close to, there's got to be like a psychological name for this, for what this phenomenon is. And I'm not talking about liberal bias here. If it leads, it leads kind of thing. If it's close, then it leads. You know, you want there to be a contest. But I will say this, I do think that the media's changed, and I do suspect that Donald Trump is going to, that we're going to have months and months and months. Because number one, Trump, I do not think he has the capacity to do what he did after the election, which was to get on a teleprompter and give, you know, a thoughtful and prudent and scripted speech. He can't do that. You know, I interviewed Mitch McConnell last night at AEI. We talked, you know, for about an hour. But one of the things McConnell said was, you know, he ran into Donald Trump and he asked Trump, you know, "Do you have your notes?" And Trump's like, "I have a script, but I don't use the script because it's boring." And McConnell said, "Well, you know what, I kind of like boring." And I don't know that Trump could stay on script for, you know, 5 weeks, 5 days, never mind 5 months. And so, number one, Trump's not going to stay on message. And number two, I think the media is going to pound them. So, you know, I'm much less bullish this week than I was even a week ago.
So I have a piece in Politico, coming off of the declaration of Hillary being the presumptive nominee, where she goes from here, which is titled, "Can Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama Save the Establishment?" So, you know, you're just saying, you know, Trump's in a weak place. People are less likely to assume that he can lead a populist movement to defeat, you know, the embodiment of the political establishment, Hillary Clinton. Hillary, you know, unlike Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, staved off the populist wave in her party to win. On one hand, there is a clear need to win back the Bernie vote, or at least a large share of it, to go going forward. But there's also this huge temptation to try to win over the disaffected Republicans and other moderate swing voters who aren't necessarily Bernie-style populace. And I looked at the speeches that Hillary gave last week and Barack Obama gave last week, one day apart. And there are a lot of lines in both speeches that are really geared to defending, you know, establishment positions against populist broadsides. You know, particularly on trade. You know, I mean, Hillary, you know, Obama is, you know, more an outright defender of TPP, and Hillary still says she rejects a vote on TPP even after the election. But they both went after Trump for openly welcoming a trade war and making the case that that would hurt American workers to be that confrontational with China. You had Hillary Clinton in her speech talk about America being an exceptional nation, quoting Lincoln that it's indispensable, and that its need on the global stage should not be, that they should not withdraw from the global stage, which is, you know, she's always drawn a line with Bernie, even when Bernie tried to hit her on her record on Libya, for example. You know, she always defended the Libya intervention, so that's not necessarily new for her. But, you know, Trump actually was quoted this week saying that America should not be considered exceptional. He may make in the case that Barack Obama made, you know, a couple years ago.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing, Bill, that that obviously where, you know, Hillary can drive a wedge between Trump and conservatives. And I don't know if you saw this. This liberal, I forget which one it was, one of these outside groups for Hillary, ran this ad about Trump and insulting that, you know, sort of mocking a reporter with a disability. And
yeah, that was a Priorities USA ad.
Okay, so that ad, I don't know if you would pick up on this or not, or if it's sort of like a dog whistle, but that ad totally tapped into kind of like a pro-life vibe.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first half of that ad could have been a pro-life ad. I mean, it's, you know, things like about human dignity. I'm not saying that conservatives or pro-lifers have a monopoly on this, but I'm just saying I think it's intentionally using messages that I think would really appeal to evangelicals and to other pro-lifers. And I think the goal is to, I think there's going to be a real goal, not to get us to vote for Hillary, but to get, you know, compassionate conservatives and really principled pro-lifers to just stay home. It seems like that is a strategic goal that they're aiming for.
Well, I would think with social conservatives, that's probably the best you're going to get. I don't think you can get social conservatives to vote Hillary. I do think you can get national security hawks and, you know, pro-trade free marketers. I think you can get them to vote Hillary. And you think it's a reach? I mean, just looking at what was in Hillary's remarks, you know, and Barack Obama, you know, he called the Republican Party in his remarks in Elkhart, Indiana last week. He called them anti-trade. Anti-government, anti-immigrant, anti-trade, and therefore anti-change.
See, that's a mistake. That's a mistake, Bill. When he does that, he's driving us away. He should look at what Hillary Clinton did a much better job. Did you see her big foreign policy speech last week?
Well, that's where it should be the American exceptionalism comment.
Okay, that speech was a speech that it did what Reagan used to do. You know, Reagan never talked about the Democrat Party because he had been part of the Democratic Party and he wanted Democrats to support him. And I think Hillary, whereas Obama can't help scoring points and assigning blame and sort of, I think, alienating Republicans and conservatives who might otherwise like him a lot more. I think Hillary's being actually best in this instance smarter and better than Obama.
Well, but I think you should look at this as a tag team. You know, they both, I think, want Hillary to run a big tent race.
But let me just say, attract Republicans by mocking Republicans. What you have to do is otherize Donald Trump. And I think that's a very key distinction.
But they have to do that. If you're going to run a Big Ten race, you got to woo the Never Trump Republicans without alienating the Bernie populist on the left.
Right. Which is, of course, the other angle. Donald Trump now, we'll see how long it lasts, is now reaching out to the Bernie Sanders people to try to get them.
You know, Obama has more credibility on the left than Hillary does. I mean, there are folks on the left that are anti both of them. So I'm not saying Obama is a magician, but you know, the Gallup puts out demographic breakdowns of his approval every week. You know, Obama's approval with liberals is 84%. So if you have Obama making that trade argument while bashing Republicans, that arguably softens up the left to accept what Hillary is doing, while she has more of a broadly bipartisan type message.
That's a fair point. My only pushback would be that if that's a strategic move, good cop, bad cop, and Obama buys her cover, then that's very smart. But I think this is who Obama is. I don't think he is a uniter. I think that he, I think this may be strategic, but I also think it fits very well with his MO.
I mean, it's hard to get, you know, totally inside his head. My point is they're doing this together while taking stances that are not Bernie stances. I mean, in Obama's speech, you know, he mixed it up. He did take a stance that the brave people love. He embraced expanding Social Security. He got headlines for saying he was going to expand Social Security. He did not get headlines for the trade part of his speech. The left was really angry with Obama a couple years ago because he flirted with changing the Social Security cost of living formula that would reduce the curve and, you know, cut benefits over time. He got lauded on the left for doing that. So is there a way that, I mean, this is a real tightrope walk they're trying to do together. So the only point I'm making here is that they seem to be trying to defend the establishment generally from the populist broadside. So when you, even as they try to bring people back into the fold, you know, I don't think Hillary's going to flip-flop on TPP at this point. But she doesn't want the broader Trump argument on trade to carry the day. So she has to find a way to walk a line on it. And that's why I think they're doing.
So how's it end for Bernie? How does this go? How does this end?
Well, I mean, there's a piece I wrote about that. I mean, there's a piece I wrote for Politico before the race, which is What If Bernie Wins California, which looked at the last Democrats to make a final stand after winning. You know, so you had this stretch in the 76, 80, 84, where the pledged delegate winner lost California on the last day, and not just as like a one-off, but usually losing the majority of states on that day. You know, Carter never won California in anything. He lost both California primaries. He lost it to Reagan twice. In 76, though, there was this collection of opponents, Jerry Brown, Frank Church, Hubert Humphrey, there wasn't a single opponent to take a stand at the convention. So it wasn't that hard for him to overcome that sour note at the end. But 1980, it was Ted Kennedy. And so not only did Ted Kennedy try to unbind the delegates on the last day, which and that gambit lost, He gave the Dream Will Never Die speech, which everybody quotes today. That speech was a precursor to the platform fight he wanted to wage. He had a line in that speech where he said, "We will never compromise on jobs for everybody." I'm not quoting him exactly, forgive me. But that was not just a liberal boilerplate thing to say. Carter had definitively said that jobs were not the top priority right then and there. Inflation was the top priority. We had to beat inflation. It's hurting people's pocketbooks. It's diminishing their earnings. We got to take care of that. And to do a big public works jobs program was going to increase inflation. So that was fundamentally the wrong strategy. Kennedy wins that platform fight. wins over the delegates, wins the platform fight, and puts into the convention rules that the nominee has to issue a statement supporting the platform generally and enumerate whatever reservations he has. So he further embarrasses Carter on that score. In 1984, Gary Hart wins almost all the final states except for New Jersey, West Virginia. He screws up New Jersey by insulting it for its toxic waste problems a few days before, but he wins California and a few other states. He makes the Bernie argument. I may be short on delegates, but the superdelegates should flip. This is the first year they really had supers. I poll better than Mondale against Reagan. I have the young vote. You know, we're going to bring this to the convention. He tries to flip the supers. It doesn't work. But he extracts something out of the platform. He gets a peace plank, which Mondale was uncomfortable with, but he gave it to him after massaging the language. So that's where this is going. You know, Bernie wants to win the platform. He wants to be able to say that he's the heart and soul of the party. The argument is diminished after losing California, but he still has delegates. And he still can say, if you don't come my way, my people are going to walk, and that's not going to help you. Hillary can come back at him and say, you know, if you don't play ball with me, your reputation will be besmirched. You're going to lose your ability to be influential in the party. Your legacy is going to be electing Donald Trump. You don't want that either. So I think they both have cards to play and both have reason to compromise. But that's where we're headed into a very delicate series of negotiations between now and the convention and possibly during the convention if Bernie doesn't stand down before then.
All right. Good stuff. I think we're probably about out of time, Bill, but I do want to
quickly talk about talking to Mitch McConnell on stage yesterday.
Yeah, no, it was cool. So Mitch McConnell has a new book. The Senate Majority Leader has a new book out. It's called The Long Game, and it's a memoir, and I recommend it.
Is it a good book? Can you actually read the book and enjoy it?
I read the whole book, and I did enjoy it. And if you're a political, I mean, if you don't like politics, you're going to like it. But if you're a political junkie, you're going to like it. I mean, Mitch McConnell overcame polio. It's really a story of overcoming, and it's called The Long Game, honestly, because, to sort of make it a kid with polio, to sort of and a shy kid, to ultimately become the Senate Majority Leader, and all the struggles, and it took him a long time to achieve it. So it's a great story. Obviously, we talked about that, and obviously, we talked about people like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Jim DeMint and things like that. So. And we did a lightning round that was pretty fun, where I would just ask you, I would throw out a name of somebody, and he would answer quickly. So he was kind enough to play along with that. It was at the American Enterprise Institute. Arthur Brooks introduced us. It was overflow crowd. I think they probably had to end up turning, standing room only. I think they probably had to turn some people away. And you can find it. They live streamed it. You can find the hour on their website. It's on YouTube. I put it on my Facebook page. I'm going to try to repurpose the audio for my podcast, my audio podcast as well. So really great experience. And it's been picked up a lot. His comments about Trump, that he should apologize, and that essentially that what he's doing is stupid, have been picked up. I've seen it on CNN and MSNBC. At least all day today. So you can just see me. You'll see me sitting there. You don't see me talking, but you just see me sitting there watching McConnell and the clips that have been played kind of ad nauseum.
I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but so I want to ask you one question. Any sense from him that he has regrets about how he has handled things in the Obama era and how that has led to the Trump phenomena that we are in today?
No. I asked him a question that would have given an opportunity for that, and he does not show any signs of contrition. If you read the book, he does point out, you know, the sort of the famous or the infamous line that where Mitch McConnell says, you know, my number one priority is to make sure that Barack Obama is a one-term president. It's important to note that I think that line came in like 2010 or something. People think it was immediately after Obama was elected. It was quite some time after he was elected. And the other thing is that McConnell says that nobody else ever actually quotes the full quote or what he went on to say, that Bob Woodward is the only person who actually reported on the full comments, which, you know, paraphrasing here, after McConnell says the priority is to make sure Obama doesn't win re-election, he goes on to say, but of course, when there are areas where we can work together, we should certainly work together with them. And we should certainly try to get things done for the American people. And so, you know, in the book, he talks about that. And McConnell in the book, and also during our discussion at AEI last night, very clearly he likes Joe Biden a lot. And he feels like when you negotiate with Barack Obama, with President Obama, rather than just sort of assuming, look, we're both pros, we both have a worldview, that Obama tries to lecture you. I think the chapter is called Professor Obama, that Obama wants to actually try to like win an argument with you, as opposed to saying, okay, Mitch, it's crazy, but you believe X, we believe Y. How do we get, you know, how do we come together on this? And so, you know, it's pretty obvious from talking to him and reading the book that Mitch McConnell likes Joe Biden and feels that the good stuff that has happened, that they've gotten done, Biden has played a big role in sort of brokering those deals.
I think Boehner has made similar comments in the past. That's just different mentalities. People who are just, you know, legislative tacticians, they talk a different language than people who have more of a visionary approach to politics.
And McConnell, and I will say too, McConnell, we talk about Trump and about the recent controversy. You know, people don't realize it. Very, very quietly, Mitch McConnell was sort of a civil rights champion in the party of Lincoln. I mean, this is a guy who voted against Barry Goldwater because Goldwater opposes the Civil Rights Act. He voted to overturn Ronald Reagan's veto having to do with apartheid and South Africa. He was, talks about, I think he was there when LBJ signed one of those landmark civil rights legislation. He was there at MLK's speech, the March on Washington. So this is a guy who, you know, is being put in a really difficult position in terms of his legacy. And on top of that, this is a guy who's really pragmatic and disciplined and kind of prides himself on being boring and who just has to sit there and watch Donald Trump, you know, go off script. And in fact, during our talk yesterday, that it's not McConnell, it's not his condemnation on Trump morally or ethically, it's his condemnation for Trump for being a bad politician that is what's gotten the airplay today. For what
very
that's
interesting.
Worth.
So do check out the full conversation between Matt Lewis and Mitch McConnell. Check out my piece at Politico. Can Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama save the establishment? Hopefully we can talk to you next week here on the DMZ.
You got it. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.